I'd like now to introduce Dr. Handel Reynolds. He is a breast radiologist at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, and was formerly chief breast radiologist at Indiana University, and he's author of the new book, The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me on your show.
So this is a fascinating little book. It's not long, but it's densely packed. Cancer screening turns out to be as much of a political as it is a scientific or medical story. Tell us about the whole beginnings of the fight against cancer in the 1970s.
Right. So mammography was first introduced on a large scale to the United States in 1973. And in that year, the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society jointly embarked upon a program known as the BCDDP. And this program would run for about 5 years. And over that period of time, they recruited about 280,000 women from all across the country to undergo annual mammography and physical examination for breast cancer screening. This was the first demonstration of mammography on a large scale. Now, mammography actually was first developed way back many decades earlier. In fact, the first reports we have of radiologists or physicians taking x-rays of the breast come from the 1930s. But in the early days, these x-rays were very difficult to produce on a consistent basis, and it really wasn't until the late 1960s to the early 1970s that some of those technical challenges were solved and mammography became a feasible undertaking. Now, what was going on in the larger society in the early 1970s is the following. First of all, President Nixon signed the National Cancer Act in 1971, and this new legislation provided large quantities of federal funds for cancer control programs and other efforts aimed at defeating cancer. And in fact, mammography was one of the first projects to be studied using these new federal anti-cancer funds. At the same time, we had the women's health movement, which was part of the larger feminist movement that had been occurring in the 60s and the early 70s. And finally, we had the American Cancer Society's decades-long program of promoting early detection as a means of controlling cancer. Now, of course, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, early detection for breast cancer meant examining your breast, finding an abnormality if it were present, and presenting to your doctor promptly. With the advent of mammography in the late 60s to early 1970s, the paradigm changed, and this new technology was added to women's healthcare recommendations for breast cancer early detection.
I think it's really important. It's something that you point out in your book, that the stage had been set for early detection by the pap smear, which was something by which cervical cancer could be detected so early that it was basically prevented, whereas in breast cancer, detection doesn't equal prevention.
That is correct. And in fact, the American Cancer Society was very involved in the dissemination of the pap smear technology in the 1940s and 1950s. And those early efforts were very successful in reducing the death rate from cervical and uterine cancer. And so when the early research into mammography and its possible capabilities became known in the late 1960s, there was a hope amongst the folks at the American Cancer Society that this could possibly represent the pap smear for breast cancer, that it would have a similar impact on this disease. Well, in fact, over the ensuing decades, as we have promoted mammography, we have not necessarily educated the public fully on what a mammogram is or what it does. In fact, there have been multiple surveys that have shown that large segments of the population actually views mammography as prevention as opposed to early detection. And that is part of what I talk about in the book, is that we've used sort of a flawed messaging when it comes to mammography campaigns over the past several decades.
One of the things that I learned from your book, which I think is very important to talk about also, is this big BCDDP study was actually a demonstration study, and it was not a controlled clinical study the way you would normally do. In other words, they did screening on thousands and thousands of women, but they didn't have a control group to compare it to.
Right. So the BCDDP, or the Breast Cancer Detection Demonstration Program that I referenced earlier, started in 1973. Now, normally, a demonstration program is done to show the feasibility of a large-scale application of a technology that has already been proven to be beneficial. Now, in the early 1970s, the only real scientific evidence we had on the benefits of mammography came from a study that was done in New York in the early 1960s called the HIP study. And it showed a benefit for women 50 to 59 years old, but no benefit for women under the age of 50. And partly that was because there were insufficient numbers of younger women in this study. When the BCDDP was rolled out by the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute, they screened women as young as 35 years of age. And that decision, while it was not necessarily criticized initially, within 3 years of the rollout of this program, this issue of whether younger women should be screened, especially in the absence of any scientific validation for that, became front and center. And there was a huge eruption of controversy in 1976 about this issue. In fact, a scientist at the National Cancer Institute, a man by the name of John Baylor, was the first to raise the flag of caution, saying these younger women may in fact be harmed by the radiation involved in mammography. And so we see this controversy erupting 3 years after mammography was unveiled, and this controversy has occurred repeatedly through the entire history of screening in this country.
So let's talk about that for a moment. Is there a risk of the radiation that's used in what's basically an X-ray of a woman's breast? You write about that there were some machines in the past that weren't working very well.
Exactly. They were improperly calibrated. These are machines that were part of the BCDDP. What women should understand today is that there have been substantial improvements in the technology behind a mammogram, and the amount of radiation that is received today is significantly less than in those early days of mammography. So while radiation-induced breast cancer is a theoretical risk, it is a very, very small risk. And if I could give you some context, we are all exposed to a certain amount of background radiation as we walk around on the surface of this planet, and much of that comes from what's called cosmic radiation from outer space. Depending on where we live, we might be exposed to radon gas. So there's a certain amount of naturally occurring radiation to which we're all exposed. A mammogram exposes a woman to about 7 weeks' worth of this naturally occurring radiation. So, yes, there is a small amount of radiation, but it is, in fact, quite small. Now, there was an analysis performed some years ago, and they found that in a hypothetical group of 100,000 women who underwent screening every year, starting at age 40 and concluding at age 74, there could theoretically be up to 11 women who would die of breast cancer caused by mammography. However, during that same period, there would be about 500 women whose lives would be saved by early detection afforded through a mammogram. So, yeah, there is a risk. It is a very small risk, and it ought to be discussed, but it is not, in fact, one of the major risks associated with mammography, in my opinion.
So the question still remains whether there is clear evidence for or against routine breast cancer screenings for women in their 40s. It's well established for women in their 50s and older, but what about younger?
Yes, so where we stand now is this. There is a benefit to routine screening every year or every other year, for women in their 40s and women in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and so forth. However, the magnitude of that benefit increases with age. So a 60-year-old woman who undergoes regular mammography derives a greater magnitude of benefit, and we define benefit as the likelihood of dying of breast cancer, as opposed to a woman in her 40s. So that benefit changes with age. Now, the other side of the equation is there are certain risks or harms associated with mammography, such as false positives, and something we may get into in a few minutes, overdiagnosis. Some of these risks are more common in younger women, like false positives. So there is a risk-benefit ratio that needs to be considered. That risk-benefit ratio becomes more favorable to screening the older the woman. But there is a benefit basically at all ages, the benefit increases with age, and some of the risks may become less common with age. And so what I propose in the book is, rather than the approach that we've used over the past multiple decades, which I call the just do it approach, where we basically tell women to undergo mammography just because we say so, because it's good for them, we should rather adhere to an informed decision-making approach where we give women all the information, risks and benefits, and empower and allow them to make a choice that is appropriate for them.
What is the actual risk of a false positive?
So it's been estimated that a 40-year-old woman who begins annual screening at age 40 and is screened every year until she turns 50, there is a greater than 50% likelihood that she will experience a false positive mammogram. Now, we should define what a false positive is. So a false positive means that a woman undergoes a routine mammogram and she's recalled by the facility for some more work. So, for example, it may be additional mammogram pictures, it may be an ultrasound, it may even be a biopsy. But at the end of the day, when that's all done, there is no cancer. So that's a false alarm or a false positive. And false positives are more common in younger women than in older women. A 40-year-old woman has a higher rate of false positives than a 60-year-old woman, for example. And that's partly because breast cancer becomes more common as you get older. So false positive readings is one of the risks or one of the harms of screening that really ought to be discussed.
But it's not really a harm, is it? I mean, I have to say, that happened to me. I had a mammogram. They called me in again. Then they sent me home and said, yeah, no problem. And it was barely a blip on the radar screen of my life.
And your experience is so typical. There have been multiple studies that have shown that at the time of the false positive, in the moment, there's a high degree of psychological stress. But way over 90% of women who experience a false positive mammogram continue to undergo mammography on a regular basis. So there is no long-term detriment to continued screening associated with a false positive. However, it is still something that needs to be considered because a false positive involves additional radiation in many cases and a biopsy, or possibly a biopsy. So while it is not a major detriment to most women, in the interest of full disclosure, we ought to discuss these risks.
There's also the issue that younger women tend to have denser breasts, and denser breasts come up white in the mammograms, and tumors come up white, so it's really hard to distinguish one from the other.
Yes, that's absolutely true. So on a mammogram, we typically see a combination of white tissue and dark tissue. The white tissue is what we call dense breast tissue. The darker tissue is what we call fatty tissue. Now, some mammograms are primarily white. Others are primarily dark. Others are a combination. Younger women tend to have a more fibrous, more dense tissue than older women. Now, a breast cancer, as you've rightly pointed out, typically shows up as a white object on a mammogram. So if you imagine putting a white object in a white background, it's very difficult to perceive. So our likelihood of missing a cancer is greater among women who have dense breasts. And as your audience may be aware, there is now a trend, a movement that is growing across this country to mandate mammography facilities notifying their clients, their patients, whether they have dense breast tissue. So a woman who has a mammogram, she's to be informed that she has dense breast tissue and is to be advised that she may want to consider additional screening, for example, with ultrasound or MRI. This is now state law in California, New York, Virginia, Texas, and Connecticut, and there is similar legislation pending in probably another dozen or 15 states or so. So this is a possible risk of screening. It's called a false negative. So there's really cancer there, but you don't see it. That's a false negative. This is a harm of screening, and we are just now starting to come to grips with the significance of this and the ramifications of this major limitation.
We're talking to Dr. Handel Reynolds, author of the book The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. I just saw a TED talk by a doctor who was involved with developing an imaging technique called molecular breast imaging. And that basically, according to this talk that I saw, it was a TED talk, is very effective in women who have breast tissue and in detecting cancers.
Yes. So there are a couple different forms of molecular imaging that are being tested. The problem with both of them, the two that we have available now, one is called breast-specific gamma imaging and the other is called positron emission mammography, or PEM, is that both are associated with exceedingly high doses of radiation, substantially higher than a mammogram, because both involve an injection. So the patient would receive an injection of a radiopharmaceutical that then travels throughout the body, but is selectively picked up in breast tumors and other breast abnormalities. So now we're not just talking about the effect of radiation on the breast tissue, but because this radiation now is traveling throughout the body, you have an effect on other parts of the body. For example, the bladder and the urinary system, because many of these substances are excreted in the urine. So these have been studied, and the major limitation right now, as I see it and as others see it, is the exceedingly high radiation dose associated with these techniques. And until the radiation dose is brought down more in line with mammography, I think that is going to be a major hindrance to the adoption of these types of imaging techniques to look for breast cancer. Because, you know, after all, we are more than just one body part, and the amount of radiation one receives to the rest of the body from these techniques is quite high.
Let's talk about ductal carcinoma, which was virtually undetectable before mammography. What is it, and how dangerous is it opposed to other breast cancers?
So ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS, otherwise known as stage zero breast cancer, as you have stated, was virtually unheard of prior to mammography. Now, this is a stage of breast cancer where the cancer cells are completely within the milk duct. There is no tumor, no mass. Typically, there are no signs or symptoms. So prior to mammography, this constituted about 1% of all breast cancers. Since the advent of mammography, there has been an explosion in the number of DCIS cases. There are about 50 to 60,000 women a year diagnosed with this condition today. And in fact, now it constitutes anywhere from 20 to 25% or higher of the total breast cancer burden in this country. Now, the thing about DCIS is, while we are finding lots and lots of these lesions, and you may think, well, that's great, we're finding really, really early breast cancer, the problem is we know that most of these, if left alone, would not progress to what's called invasive breast cancer. That's important because DCIS by itself, if it remains DCIS, if it stays in the milk duct, it is completely harmless. It cannot kill. It cannot spread. It cannot do any damage. If it becomes invasive breast cancer, which is the next stage up, then that has the potential to spread and to kill. Well, we believe that probably no more than a third to a half of these DCIS lesions, if left alone, would progress to invasive cancer. So on that basis, many of the DCIS lesions that are now detected are felt to represent overdiagnosis. Now, what is the role of mammography in this? These DCIS lesions are found very easily on mammography. They show up as little white specks on the mammogram. These are called microcalcifications. And that is the reason why now that we are screening for breast cancer with mammography, we are finding so many of these DCIS lesions, and there's no way to distinguish between the ones that could be safely left alone and the ones that need to be treated. So all women with DCIS undergo treatment, and this also is one of the limitations or harms or risks of screening. It's known as overdiagnosis.
I was thinking, what if I were in that position, that I had a mammogram and I went in and they said, oh, you have this DCIS, which will become invasive only in one-third to one-half. Well, that means that I've got a coin toss chance, basically, of having invasive cancer. If I had a 1 in 10 chance, I would have it removed. So why wouldn't you? I mean, what's wrong with treating in that case?
Oh, there's absolutely nothing wrong with treating, and in fact, you should treat, because we don't know how to distinguish between the good actors and the bad actors. In our limited knowledge, in the limited knowledge that we find ourselves in now, we do have to treat everyone, but we clearly need to redouble our efforts on the research front to try to find out molecularly or genetically a way to distinguish these DCIS lesions one from another, because I don't think it's reasonable to say, well, we find it, let's treat it, and it's not a problem. I think there is potentially a problem, and I think we really need to focus our efforts on trying to distinguish the good from the bad so that in the future, not every woman who is found to have DCIS necessarily has to have a lumpectomy and radiation or a mastectomy. I mean, it's major surgery. But the fact is, we find it, and we have to treat it because we cannot separate the good from the bad with current technology.
The DCIS detection that mammograms have been able to do so efficiently is, as you write, pretty much responsible for the word epidemic being applied to breast cancer. Is that correct?
That's part of it. That is part of it. In 1985, the American Cancer Society announced that the lifetime risk of developing breast cancer for an American woman had gone from 1 in 13 to 1 in 10 in the past decade. And a few years later, they announced a change saying the lifetime risk was now 1 in 9. Those changes occurred in the midst of a growing AIDS epidemic, and breast cancer itself took on an epidemic narrative around that same time. What was never made clear to the public is that the quote-unquote breast cancer epidemic was largely driven by screening. So it's partly DCIS, but also by screening for breast cancer, you do find small invasive cancers as well. You will find more if you look harder. So there was not a true epidemic. We were basically witnessing a screening-generated phenomenon, and that was responsible for the bulk of the rise in breast cancer cases in that time period. Now, of course, part of the rise was also women were living longer, and as you live longer, you don't die of other things earlier, you become susceptible to breast cancer the longer you live. So those were the reasons why we saw this rise in breast cancer incidence rates in the 70s, I'm sorry, in the 80s and 90s, and breast cancer took on this epidemic narrative.
We're talking to radiologist Handel Reynolds. So how effective is self-examination in finding breast cancer and reducing cancer deaths?
All right. So your audience may recall that when the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force made their changes on mammography in 2009, they also essentially said that physicians should discontinue teaching the practice of breast self-examination because there was no evidence that teaching BSC or breast self-examination made any difference. And true enough, there have been many large studies that have looked at whether teaching breast self-examination results in a lower death rate of breast cancer, and those studies have been inconclusive. So there's no definite scientific evidence that is of benefit. But even beyond that, I've been in this business now for over 20 years, and I can tell you from talking to countless women, they almost invariably tell me that breast self-examination is frankly very difficult because breasts are often very lumpy, often tender. Patients don't know what is real, what is not real, what should be a cause for concern and what shouldn't. And many, many patients just give up in despair because it is so difficult. So rather than pushing a regimented approach to breast self-examination, I think what's more important is what folks call breast awareness. Be aware of changes in your breast, changes that you might observe in the shower or changing your clothes. Breast self-awareness is how most women who actually find their own cancer find it, as opposed to practicing the 10 delineated principles of strict breast self-examination. So be aware of your breasts. Be aware of any changes you might see. See your doctor promptly and have those changes evaluated.
Yeah, I have to say, a relative of mine who has mammograms every year just detected a cancer with her fingers in the shower, and and has a much higher survival rate, I think, because she detected it.
Exactly. That is very, very common. I can tell you most women I meet who happen to find their own cancer find it completely by accident, just like that. Not by doing, you know, the shower card BSC model. It's by just being aware, oops, that feels different. Where did that come from? Type thing.
Right. So this has become a very political issue over the years. I mean, it really has been from the beginning. And I wanted to ask you, how powerful is the voice of the mammography industry in this whole debate, considering, I mean, this is a capitalist country, and they certainly would suffer a tremendous loss of market share if some group of people were no longer within the recommendation guidelines?
Well, the American College of Radiology has been sort of arm in arm with the American Cancer Society in promoting mammography really since the earliest days of this technology. In fact, the American College of Radiology in the 1970s moved to begin recommending screening mammography for women under the age of 50. At that time, there was really no scientific basis for that, but it was felt that there was some possible hope that future research would show a benefit. So both of these organizations have largely promoted mammography over the past several decades using the approach of basically just do it. We believe this is good. We have evidence that it's good. You should just do it. And that is great if your goal is to increase utilization. And that has been successful. The vast majority of women who should be having mammograms are having mammograms. But it is not the right approach if the goal is patient education or consumer education. So if mammography has been promoted using the benefits, so there is a likelihood you will reduce your risk of dying of breast cancer, but we have given very little discussion. When I say we, I mean those who have been promoting mammography, and I am a radiologist, so, you know, guilty as charged. We have not spoken very much to the public about the risks, the benefits. We have not given the full picture. And clearly part of the reason for writing this book is to educate, inform, and hopefully empower women to make these choices for themselves. So, you know, directly to your question, who's making money? You know, mammography is, as far as imaging tests are concerned, mammography is not a huge money maker. The reimbursement rate for mammography is kept low in the Medicare program to make sure that women have access to the technology. And I think radiologists, by and large, who do this, do it out of a passion that, you know, it is a life-saving test and ought to be supported. That is not to say that mammography doesn't drive, you know, a whole lot of other stuff. There's a huge collateral economy, as you well know, that has sprung up around breast cancer and breast cancer screening. And, you know, in October, we see that in full fruition. You know, a big part of that clearly is mammography screening.
What is cause-related marketing, and how much does it help breast cancer research and patients?
Well, that's a good question. Cause-related marketing basically is what we see in October every year, where various companies will, you know, become pink, basically, and say if you buy this product or you support this particular service, that a part of the funds will go towards fighting breast cancer. And in many cases, what that means is very nebulous, and that's why I can't give a clear-cut answer, because it varies from organization to organization, company to company. And so I think it behooves us all as informed and educated consumers to ask questions. If you choose to buy product A over product B because you think it will help the fight against breast cancer, you should ask, you know, how much of this is going to go to a particular, thing that I care about. Will this go to research? Will this go to providing mammograms? What exactly does this money go to support? And not just, you know, see the pink and say, well, you know, I'm helping breast cancer because it's October and that's pink.
And this is America, and there's a basically 100% certainty that someone somewhere has put pink ribbons on something.
Clearly. There are pink ribbons on everything.
And none of that money actually goes to anybody.
I think a good portion of it goes nowhere that you would be interested in. You're absolutely right. And that's why you need to ask questions. Clearly, there are some legitimate aims at cause-related marketing and pink marketing, so to speak. And you just have to ask questions. Don't assume that you're helping fight breast cancer just because the product is draped in pink.
Now, there has been, as you write, a 31% reduction in the death rate for breast cancer over the last couple of decades. To what do you attribute this? Break it down for us.
Yes, and this has been studied extensively, and clearly some of that benefit derives from early detection with mammography, and clearly some of it is derived from improved treatments. We have so many additional drugs and better drugs that we've brought to the fight against breast cancer, so clearly there is some benefit that comes from both of those approaches. Some studies have shown that it's about a 50-50 split. Others have shown that it's mainly improved therapies. So we don't know exactly, but those two clearly share the credit for reducing the death rate by about 30% over the past two decades.
What would you recommend to women in their, I mean, there are women who get breast cancer in their 30s. What would you recommend to women in the, or younger even, but to women in their 30s, 40s, and beyond in terms of the most rational mammogram screening procedure?
Well, let's look at it this way. Your audience may be aware of a study that was published just about 2 weeks ago where they found that women who are at exceptionally high risk of breast cancer, women who are gene positive, suffered a greater incidence of breast cancer if they underwent mammography or other X-ray tests prior to the age of 30. So we should say, first of all, that we generally, clearly in women who are at high risk, we discourage them from having mammograms at an early age, certainly under the age of 30. For average risk women, we generally recommend that you start mammographic screening at age 40. For women who have a family history, for example, if a woman has a mother or a sister who had breast cancer at, say, 40, you may want to start a little earlier, 35 or so would be appropriate. But I want to go back again to what I said earlier, and I think informed decision-making is the approach that we really ought to take. And I know we've, for most of this time, we've employed these one-size-fits-all approaches, and I think women ought to be given an opportunity to speak to their physicians about the benefits and the risks of mammography. Clearly, there are benefits. Clearly, there are downsides, and we should allow women to ask questions and find out for themselves the risks and benefits and make a choice that suits them. So some women may choose to begin screening at 40. Others may choose to wait till they're 50. And quite honestly, there are perfectly rational women who, having been given the pros and the cons, may choose not to be screened at all. And I think all of these decisions need to be supported.
And do you feel that at this point in history, doctors are properly educated about these risks and benefits?
And that's a very important point, because there have been several studies that have shown that doctors themselves are not fully educated on these points. And so we clearly need to start with the medical profession as well and recognize also that we are all different. We approach these things differently. Some of us as patients prefer to have our doctors tell us exactly what to do, and that's fine. If you prefer that kind of doctor-patient relationship where you say, "Doc, what should I do about this?" Fine. There are others who prefer to be involved, to take a more active role in their health care. And I think both of those approaches need to be recognized by physicians and, as best we can, supported.
Dr. Handel Reynolds is a radiologist at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta. He's author of the book, The Big Squeeze, A Social and Political History of the Controversial Mammogram. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It was my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on your show.
And I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Clinton Ross. He's a legislative aide to former Governor Gary Johnson. He's a longtime observer of New Mexico politics. He's currently a blogger for LibertyNewMexico.com. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So we always talk on this program to, well, a lot of Democrats, some Republicans, You are a libertarian. What are libertarians all about?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me on the show, particularly in places like Santa Fe. We don't always get a chance to express our views here. And I guess a libertarian, most succinctly put, would be one who looks for minimal intrusion of government upon a person and even a society's conduct of life. And whereas Republicans and Democrats, for various reasons, want to promote government to further their particular interests, libertarians go exactly the opposite direction.
And so how did Governor Gary Johnson try to do that in his administration?
Well, you know, Governor Johnson was, he was known as, Governor No, because he vetoed probably more legislation than he actually signed, based on his philosophy that we already have enough laws, and if anything, we ought to reduce what we've got now. And then you saw it in some of his other policies, some of his, legalization of illicit substances right now, and his declaration that this massive government-run war on drugs was a complete disaster, and, some of his tax policies and other things like that.
Now, what's your perspective looking back on Governor Richardson's administration?
Well, I appreciate that Governor Richardson cut income tax. That was something that Governor Johnson had been trying to do for years, and I liked his I liked that he passed the concealed carry permit situation. But other than that, I didn't really have much use for Big Bill, to be honest with you. Although I did appreciate the scarves that he wore. I thought that was a that was a nice touch. I saw a picture of him once with the Dalai Lama, and there he was with a big orange scarf on, and that, that takes some cojones in my book.
So, again, so your perspective on a Democratic governor was, okay, concealed firearms, tax cutting, which seems to be more like what Republicans tend to do. Now, what's your perspective on the Susana Martinez administration?
Well, I think, Governor Martinez, as far as government goes, is doing a fine job for the state of New Mexico. I appreciate the fact that in this last tax package that they put through, they're closing loopholes on a bunch of corporate, welfare, some of these high-wage job tax credits and manufacturing tax credits that just got way out of hand or were seriously abused. I particularly like things, it may sound kind of trivial, but, signing the bill allowing dogs on restaurant patios. I mean, that's a libertarian point of view. you should be able to take your dog where you go.
That's a dog-loving point of view from my perspective, but yes.
There you go. I'm encouraged by her mandate of firearms training for victims of domestic violence, working statewide with all the battered women shelters to teach them how to use guns to defend themselves. And
is that right?
Yeah, that's a heck of an initiative that they're pursuing. And
so wait a minute. So there's an initiative that would give firearms training to victims of domestic violence.
Yes, ma'am.
Very interesting.
And I'm told that someone inside her administration, may have had an illness and as a consequence has really seen the benefits of medical marijuana. So maybe that'll move the administration to pursue some big drug reform legislation, upcoming.
Well, so far they've been against that.
Well, things change. When you get into that office and you have some personal experience and people close to you have those kind of experiences, you begin to see the benefits of considering those policies.
Now let's talk for a moment about the film program. That's something that she ran on a platform that was kind of against the New Mexico film incentives. Has that changed?
Well, they support the film program now. I think they see the value of it, in terms of job creation and such. And one of the things when she just went to visit the new Pope in Rome, and one of the things that they did was offer a reciprocity agreement to the Vatican. Whereas if a New Mexican goes out and shoots a film in the Vatican, well, we'll offer, incentives out there. And the Pope was very pleased about that. I'm told he's a big fan of the cinema, that particularly Breaking Bad is one of his favorite TV shows.
The new Pope.
So
the new Pope watches Breaking Bad.
Well, it looks like changes are coming. You know, changes are coming to the Vatican, changes are coming to the church, and, you know, as a church-going man myself, I appreciate that.
And so there are film incentives that would allow New Mexican filmmakers to actually shoot at the Vatican, which is unusual because that's a place where you have to go through a kind of, as I've heard, kind of a real bureaucracy to be able to shoot there. And it's interesting because the Breaking Bad bill was just passed. But let's move on. What would you say are some of your criticisms of the current administration?
Well, you know, I'm not too keen on their idea to sell off one of the labs, you know, to try to close the sequester gap. You know, I know
one of the national laboratories?
One of the national labs, yeah. I know they sold that jet early on, but I think, you know, selling one of the labs has taken it a little step too far.
What do you mean, like, selling the whole lab?
Selling the whole lab, you know.
Which one?
Well, they're doing a review of it. You know, it's kind of like the BRAC situation that we went through a few years ago, the base reduction and closing rounds by the feds. And, you know, I'm from Floyd, New Mexico, and one of the bases targeted for closure back then was Cannon Air Force Base, and we had to fight our tails off to keep that facility open, and I just don't see this as being productive.
And so that lab would just go?
Yeah, we go, you know, sell it outright or lease it. There are, you know, plenty of countries or even private companies that would be interested in, you know, in having a facility like that at their disposal. And another concern that I have is, you know, with this climate change going on now, I don't know where Governor Martinez stands on this, but, you know, we're really concerned with, I don't deny climate change. I'm not a science denier or anything, but we got to prepare ourselves for this. And one of the things that really concerns me the most is, you know, migration northward of species.
That's very true. I mean, they go, as the earth warms, species go to places where it's a little cooler. And so you have northward migration of species.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, we all know how important it is to protect the integrity of our borders. And so I don't want to see, you know, animals coming out of Mexico crossing our borders, you know, essentially illegally, you know, without proper documentation and such. And, you know, we already got enough Mexican wolves up here as it is now. And, you know, next thing you know, it's going to be, you know, Gila monsters and lizards and everything. Everybody's going to think they can just come to New Mexico. And we got to do something about that now. So we're working with the administration on coming up with a plan to both secure the borders and ensure, you know, proper documentation of animals.
But you can't document animals.
Well, you know, they already do that in Switzerland to control the migration of animals between northern Italy and Switzerland. You know, the Italians don't keep as good a grip on their animal populations as they ought to. And, you know, so the Swiss have taken matters into their own hand, and I think we're facing a similar situation. You know, they actually do radio tagging there in Switzerland, and, you know, with modern technology, I don't see why this should be such a big problem.
We're talking to Clinton Ross, who is a blogger for Liberty New Mexico. Now, you've written in your blog a number of times about the New Mexico spaceport. What is going on down there?
Well, that's a facility, you know, we really support. You know, it's something that gives New Mexicans something to be proud of. And, you know, they're getting ready to launch their second orbital flight here in just a couple months. And so that's going to be a real exciting thing to see. And I think there's a big future there for the state.
Now, what do they do? Like, I could go into space?
You could go into space. If you know, right now it's kind of expensive, but pretty soon, you know, hopefully the average man or woman will be able to drive down there a little past, you know, TRC and get on a spaceship. Some of your listeners may have seen a few months back that fella, Felix Baumgartner, and jump out of that balloon for a parachute from about 130,000 feet up.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that was a heck of something right over Roswell. But that gave us an idea that, you know, maybe that's something we could do from the rockets at the spaceport too. So, you know, instead of flying up and flying back, you fly up and maybe you jump out and come back down to Earth on a parachute like that. That would be, one heck of a ride.
But you wouldn't have to.
No, it would be an option. But, you know, I know a lot of folks who'd want to do something like that.
Very interesting. Now, when you go, can you take your dog?
Not quite yet. We're working on that. I think maybe Governor Martinez will extend her dogs on patios to dogs and rockets.
I think that would be very interesting, because wasn't the dog the first mammal in space?
I think there was a dog that went up, a dog and then a monkey and then a talking monkey.
That would be we. We're talking to Clinton Ross, former aide to Governor Gary Johnson when he was governor of New Mexico. Now, what is Governor Johnson up to these days?
Well, you know, Gary's a very active and athletic individual. He's, you know, climbed Mount Everest and a number of other top mountains in the world, and he's a big triathlete. Now he's preparing for his next challenge, which is he's going to run around the entire perimeter of Antarctica. He's going to do it.
No way.
Yep. He's not taking dogs or sleds or anything like that. He's going to run. And he's getting himself in shape and is very much looking forward to that.
Now, you, Clinton Ross, are founder and blogger for LibertyNewMexico.com. Anything you want to say before we go, like just your kind of overview of politics in New Mexico today?
Well, you know, I think politics in New Mexico are moving more towards a libertarian perspective and away from big government on either side. I mean, Karl Rove is coming to town in 10 days here, and he's only sold 40 tickets at the Lenzing. You know, I mean, that should tell you something about the level of interest in big party politics anymore. You know, we'd obviously like to see an expansion of the medical marijuana program and, you know, not even confine it necessarily to medical marijuana. And, you know, gay marriage, I mean, people ought to be able to marry who they want in a libertarian view. And heck, as far as I'm concerned, when you get your marriage license, the state ought to issue you a concealed carry permit as a wedding gift as well. You know, see things moving in that way. And then I guess the last thing I'd say is on border security. You know I'm concerned about animal migration and stuff, but I think that as long as the borders are secure from a crime perspective and a military perspective, that people at least, you know, ought to be able to come and go as they please, you know, anywhere on this great earth, because that's the meaning of true liberty in my mind.
Clinton Ross, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.